What is up, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 52, and I am talking to Sarah. I came across Sarah because she actually left me a review on iTunes that was just awesome. It was my first like big review of somebody I didn't know, you know, like my mom was no longer, you know, reviewing me every time or whatever. And Sarah just left this sweetest note, and it was just, yeah, it meant a lot. You know, I started reading it and I was tearing up a little bit. I'm going to admit it. I'll admit it. It's just cool to like have somebody who, you know, caught the vision for the podcast and really liked what we were talking about on Theology of Hustle. So I tracked Sarah down and I promptly asked her for an interview because she's been thinking about these things, and like listening to the podcast has gotten her thinking about faith and work, and she's been thinking about it even before then. So I knew she had some great thoughts, and she does such a good job on this interview, just talking about things that I've never even kind of considered in her. So she is a fashion designer. She designs jackets, you know, running jackets in the Denver area. And she's just thinking through things that I'm not, because I'm not making jackets on a daily basis, you know. But we talk a lot about small business. We talk about art. We go through the history of how she sort of got where she is. I think this is such a good episode for so many reasons that I think you're going to get a lot out of what she's talking about in this episode. So yeah, it's also really cool. So if you're a runner and you like running jackets, she also is really gracious and has given me an offer code for you. So if you want 15% off of one of her jackets, use the code HUSTLE in all caps on her website and you'll get 15% off, which is pretty incredible. So if you want my life advice, listen to this episode, then go and buy a jacket. I'm just throwing it out there, you know, just in case you were wondering what I think you should do. But just, yeah, go check some of her stuff out. It's awesome. She's a great follow on Instagram with all the, you know, shows she's been going to and all that. So yeah, I just ask you to check out Sarah's stuff, check out Vander Jacket. I may just take up running just to wear a jacket. I'm thinking about it. Not sure, but we'll see. I'll let you know. Yeah, I hope you enjoy this interview. If you have a second, I just ask you to go on to iTunes or whatever app you listen to this podcast on and leave me a rating and review. It helps get the word out about A Theology of Hustle so other people can listen and know it's got good content, all that stuff. So if you're loving the podcast, I would greatly appreciate you going on and doing that for me. You can follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. And yeah, I hope you enjoy hearing from Sarah. I'd love to hear what little nuggets out of this interview you got. So feel free to hit me up on Instagram or whatever. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Sarah. All right. Well, hey, Sarah, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. This is super fun to get to meet you and chat a little bit.
Thanks for having me, Curry. I've been a great listener, like an excited listener every week. So it's awesome to be here.
That's so fun. That's so fun. I certainly appreciate, you know, all that you have said and encouraged. And so that makes it even more fun because we get to like dissect sort of some of your thoughts off of some of these interviews that I've done. So
absolutely. Cool. I'd love to.
Yeah, let's do it. So, hey, let's jump off though with just having you introduce yourself to everybody.
Okay. So my name is Sarah Vandernewt and I have a company called Vander Jacket, and I design and make original running jackets as well as some kind of small runs of windbreakers for runners. And I call them micro brews. They're all made in Denver, of local Denver fabric. And at this point, I've had my company for 8 years. I've just grown it slowly because I have little kids at home. And I just hit my 700th original jacket that I've made by hand. So things are going well.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's a small business and, you know, that's a learning curve all itself. But so that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm trying, because I saw that post on Instagram about your 700th jacket, which is awesome. I'm trying to wrap my brain around you literally sewing together 700 jackets over 8 years. That is like mind-boggling to me.
Good. I'm glad. Yeah. You know, I think the funny thing is it wouldn't be right if it was 100 years ago, because other people did that type of thing. Right. I think the thing that makes my company different is that you just don't encounter that much anymore. And also just the focus on one type of garment, you know, me making a running jacket and thinking about what would a runner need, like with a jacket. Yeah, it's very specific and narrow, but I've kind of, you know, been able to thrive with the narrowness of that choice. So,
yeah, for sure. Well, but I'm like doing a little bit of curry math, which is not high level math at all.
Okay.
But I mean, you're talking like 100 a year, right? Basically. I mean,
yeah.
So like that pace, I mean, is that pace hectic or is that just sort of slow and methodical sort of pace for you?
You know, creativity and like motivation ebbs and flows. So there's that.
Sure.
When I started out, I was really slow and also nervous, you know, at the same time, sure. Like kind of hoping I would make something great. And, you know, I had to work out the kinks with sizes, doing different sizes for different people. And it probably took me like 10 hours a jacket in the early days. And I was sewing on like a domestic machine. But now I'm pretty fast. I can make, you know, a jacket in 5 hours, sometimes slightly less if things go right. Just cause I know what I'm doing, but, I would not say it's hurried. Like I'm not stressed out. It's methodical in a sense that, you work with your hands and you really can't speed up the process too much, but I'm a lot faster than I was. I mean, I cut the time in half for sure.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's just something about like you have an, maybe this is a weird word to say, but you have sort of an intimacy with your jackets that other designers don't have, right? Because you like have labored over each and every single one.
Right. True? So true. And that's why I can sell them, because I'm not really a salesperson by nature.
Yeah.
But when I'm out there, it's like, I actually know each one of these jackets and I know what's cool about them. And I know why I made these choices. So like, if someone asks me a question, like, I can say exactly, whereas a salesperson, you know, they just have to pick out what they know and really, you know, labor the point of what they know. But yeah, I know them inside and out for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've labored over these jackets, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah.
Right.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's then jump into the history of Vander Jacket, because I'm super interested in how you got to all that. Can I back up real quick? Why running jackets? Mm-hmm. Let's jump off there and then maybe like talk about how this whole thing progressed.
Yeah.
Does that work?
Yeah, that works. Let me start. My dad ran for Nike way back.
Okay. So what does that mean? That he ran for Nike?
Okay. So he ran, the marathon for Nike and trained for them. And in this day, you couldn't accept over a certain amount of money because of, athletes being professional versus amateur type thing. And so Nike wanted to have a starter program, I guess, where they could sponsor athletes, but it was kind of like a part-time thing because it had to be legal. And these amateurs would be, you know, training under Nike's care and compete, you know, at the top level of the world. And that was called Athletics West. And it was in Eugene, Oregon. And so my dad, this is so crazy. My dad ran for Nike. And Nike helped these runners and these athletes out. They had other athletes besides marathoners. Help them find the part-time job they wanted and stuff. So ironically, Nike helped pay for some of my dad's seminary at Dallas Theological Seminary. Nike helped find my dad's first youth pastor job in Eugene part-time because they wanted them taken care of so they could train really, really hard. So it was kind of crazy. So at the time,
that is crazy.
I know, who would have thought? Times have changed in terms of like what a runner can take for pay and what a runner can win, you know, per race. But I have to brag on my dad a little bit because he's an incredible person. He was top 10 in the world in the marathon at the time. He never
Wow.
Yeah, he was fast. He never made it to the Olympics because one time his Achilles, I guess, ruptured or something during an Olympic trials. And another time we protested. And so like his window of making it to the Olympics, it was kind of shut down. But his times are like top 10 in the world around 1980. So crazy. I know. And he got third in the Boston Marathon just a couple weeks before I was born. Yeah.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's cool. That's cool.
So I grew up in a running family. And not only that, but Nike was, you know, smaller then, more experimental. My dad was always getting running gear, even after he decided, like, I'm just going to be a pastor and I'm not going to run professionally anymore. Like, he really went out on top. You know, he could have kept going, but he really decided, you know, his calling was to the pastorate. So we moved to Bend, Oregon, and Nike would still send him stuff all the time. So we were just around athletic apparel all the time. And the way my creative mind worked as a kid was all about clothes. I loved costume design. I loved just fabric and texture and everything. And my mom taught me how to sew in 4-H, and she did a really great job. So I learned how to sew, and then I was around all this athletic apparel. And, you know, fast forward to college. Do you want me to go into that?
Okay. Sure. Yeah. I'm down for whatever. Yeah, this is super interesting.
Okay. Well, so I went to college for fashion design, as I said, and then realized like a couple things. Faith and work has been a real big struggle for me personally because I was the kid who always like sewed my own clothes and like sewed my prom dresses and, you know, crazy costumes for every dance and whatever. And I knew I wanted to be a fashion designer, but I had also been on some missions trips to Mexico and seen real poverty in high school. And so when I got to college, I kind of had this tension in my head of like, how can a fashion designer charge, you know, $2,000 for a pair of shoes, you know, or some garment? And there was kind of that tension there. And I just didn't have the maturity or the theological grounding to like think about all jobs being worthwhile and good. And in my mind, this is like the naivete of youth, thinking that if I go down this road of fashion designer, I will be, you know, Chanel. Like, you know, like there's no in between. Like I had this,
it's an inevitability, right?
Like I had this idea, like, oh, if I'm a fashion designer, like I'm going to be, you know, Michael Kors or nothing. So that's kind of my brain. And, you know, I know you love the Enneagram and I'm an 8. So it kind of like fits.
Ah.
So I kind of had this in my head, like it's really all or nothing. And then I didn't have the theological grounding or I didn't grow up hearing a lot of discussion of like something that is more reformation. Or reformed, I guess, in thinking to think about all work is sanctified and holy before God. I feel like it's really emphasized maybe more for like Presbyterians and stuff. And I grew up conservative Baptist. It just wasn't a narrative I heard a lot. So in college, you know, realizing that I think I'll feel bad if I don't pursue fine art. Part of that was the sewing component of the fashion design program seemed like review. And then I was really jealous of friends who were in art classes and seeing what they were doing and learning. And then also just like spiritually deep inside, I was kind of like, I don't know if fashion design counts as like holy work, you know?
Right.
So anyway, so went to college. Afterwards, went to Denver Seminary at my dad's recommendation to study philosophy. And I was able to change it to Christian studies and focus on art history of the church. And that was incredible. But really, the wonderful thing about that experience was learning that all work is holy. You know, ministry is through all kinds of work. And you know, God makes different people for different purposes. After seminary, I married a teacher. So I thought, well, if I'm an art teacher, then I could be responsible, like a responsible artist. This would be a way for me to be a responsible artist and get paid and then also have the same life as my husband. Like we would be on the same schedule and have our summers off.
Sure. Yeah.
So I went to DU, the University of Denver, got my teaching degree. And it's really hard to get art teaching jobs because art teachers, you know, maybe at a big high school, there's only three or four. And if you get an art teaching job at a high school, it's a sweet gig. Your retirement is paid for. Your studio space is paid for. You get to share your passion with other kids. And art teachers tend to like hunker down and stay for 30 years. So it's really hard to break in. So I had the opportunity to be hired at a school for kids with emotional disorders. It was like a school where some kids who had spent time in prison had been, who have emotional disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder or obstinate defiant disorder, ODD, OCD. Then also I had a few classes of kids with autism. And so I got a job teaching art there, and they hired me even though I had no experience with mental health. Which was a risk.
Yeah. When talk about a learning curve, right? I mean,
And personally, it was very good for me. But honestly, I'm so into art that I was not, I would be so into what people are doing with their art. I'd be, you know, head down, really excited about what they're doing. And I had a few fights break out in my classroom because, well, I'm so excited here. There's this other kid over here who isn't old enough to be classified as schizophrenic, but has schizophrenia, like all the counselors know that. And there was, you know, kids who saw things, and there was a lot of just balls in the air because of the mental health component. And it was more than I had experienced. So I really focused on the art piece, but it wasn't enough, you know, to manage a classroom. And so I got fired at the end of the year. And, you know, it was good because some people, they're not going to quit a job unless they're fired. Like, I would have just kept going. I think if God wanted to redirect me, and obviously he did, he knew like I would have to be fired in order to move on.
Right.
You know, and so because there were a few times where like students attacked me and stuff, and, you know, I was definitely like punched and hit and stuff, because when you're working with that population, when you're working with that population, everyone is behaving in a way that makes sense to them. But, you know, there's a lot of, I don't know. I want to say like, one thing I learned about mental health is that everyone's behaving in a way that makes sense to them if you saw what they saw. And some kids did have, you know, they had psychotic episodes and they did see different things, and there was schizophrenia. And yeah, so that's what I learned from that experience. And it really, it made my heart bigger for people. But so after that, I got pregnant right away that summer looking for art jobs. And my husband just said, well, you could just do art at home, you know? So I didn't find anything. So I was just working on my art at home, and I had been, just like designing clothes and selling them at random flea markets. And, you know, just for fun, I'd have like a tent and come empty out my closet and like sell everything. And it would be like a skirt, a dress, you know, a jacket, this men's jacket, this random shoe. and, as I was, you know, through my pregnancy, I was getting bigger and I was still running. I've always been a lifetime runner. And, I needed a few jackets, so I sewed a few pregnancy jackets, and because I was too big for anything else, I couldn't zip them, and it was the winter, and I only ran in them a few times, and then I had my child, my first daughter, And then at a flea market, I brought those pregnancy running jackets that I had designed, and they sold right away to women who weren't pregnant. And I was like, these are pregnancy jackets. Like, and they're like, no, these are cool. These are really cool.
This is the maternity section. So, you know,
exactly. right. Yeah. And then, the rest of that day, women were coming back to my tent and saying, do you have any more of those jackets? Because I saw so-and-so wearing hers. It's so cool. And, multiple women came back and asked for it. And I didn't have them and sold them. And the next day on a run, I was just thinking, you know, in Colorado, what's the one thing everyone needs every season? It's a jacket. It's a running. Well, not necessarily a running jacket, but an athletic jacket.
Sure.
Because here, you know, the seasons change so fast. And at the time, everyone was kind of wearing the puffy coats, which are cool, but everyone was looking really uniform at the time. Sure. There weren't as many variations on the puffy coat, and, you know, women and men will buy a new jacket every season. So there's a high demand, and to do something really original and unique really stands out. So I just kind of stepped into that opportunity and decided, you know what, from now on, I'm just making athletic jackets. And since I'm a runner, I just decided, like, we'll make them running jackets because that's what I know. So I can go out for a long run and think, what would make this better? Like, what would make this experience better? And I always run in the dark because that's the time I have for it. So, you know, I think about where to put reflective and how to fit the hood, front and back pockets. I hate running in like those tool belt things, you know, so I'd rather just have lots of pockets. And how can I make a pocket that protects my phone? Because it's, you know, an $800 thing that I don't want falling on the ground.
Right.
But I need it. How am I going to listen to Theology of Hustle if I don't have it?
That's true. It's true. Good thinking.
Yeah. So, and then, yeah, just those features like thumb holes and a watch hole so you can see your watch when you're out there. And that's how I came around to designing running jackets. Long story. Nice.
Yeah, no, that's a great story. I love that story. It's such a, a roundabout way to find like something you're really passionate about, right? Because it's like all this stuff went down to find something that like you get the art piece, you get the running piece. I mean, it sort of coalesces into like one really cool thing that you get to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I kind of came back to my first love because I always wanted to be, you know, an apparel designer. And I guess now, like, with the experience from seminary and, you know, the art experience both, to just have the confidence to be doing my thing and know it's good and know like, this is how God's gifted me. This is good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Something I wanted to touch on just a little bit. So I know absolutely nothing about running culture. I'm not a runner. Curry was not built to run long distances. But can you talk just a little bit about running culture and the running jackets? I know you mentioned some of the pieces of the jacket and like what goes into it, but what is it about the culture that sort of like draws you in or running in general, I guess?
You know what I love about running? It's like the oldest sport there is. You know,
That's fair.
I really like old things. Okay. So I like old machines. I like old cars. I like old sports. And running's the oldest. It's just so simple. I love that you don't actually need anything to run. So it's very democratic in that way. You don't have to join a club. You don't have to wear shoes. Like there's a whole subculture of runners who don't wear shoes, you know, you don't need a team. You don't need to round up, you know, five other people before you can get something going. And I love just that it's really accessible and it ebbs and flows with your life. So if you are really into it and you're single and you have all this time, you can get really focused on training and races and everything. And there's all that. And that's great. And there's camaraderie there. And then if you're, you know, a new mom and you don't have a lot of time and you have, you know, half an hour, just the fact that you can go run a few laps around the block and that's better than nothing. And you count as a runner too. I love how it's really, it could be for anybody who feels like it, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
no, I think that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really pure. It's a pure sport. Yeah.
I totally get that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because I guess I'd never really thought of it that way. Especially the democratic part, like anybody, you know, it's open to sort of anybody, no matter what stage of life you're at, right? It's a sort of a lifetime sport.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's cool. Let's talk a little bit about running a business. Like, what has it been like to sort of like grow a small business, especially in your market, I guess, a smaller market, maybe. You know, you do one sort of thing, right? Or I guess you have backpacks and stuff now, don't you?
I do. I have backpacks and sweatshirts and like I said, the windbreakers I've made, which are great because they're also at a lower price point, you know. So yeah, so to buy an original piece of clothing, it's going to be expensive no matter what. But so offering some other things has been good. Yeah. You hit on my come to Jesus kind of, part of my work, because as I mentioned in my story, like I don't have any business experience.
Sure.
And,
I
think it's fascinating. I think business is really fascinating. I really like taxes.
especially right now, right?
Right. I do think it's fascinating how it works and everything I can do to learn more. Like, I want to be learning more. But sometimes I scratch my head and I think, well, why didn't I just, go through school with a fashion design degree? Because the business element would have been there. And I have to learn it in a different way. But for some reason, like, you know, seeking God's will throughout my life, like, this is the path. So that has been circumvented. And it's a daily thing. I think the biggest challenge with the small business is, at least for me, is the dance of cash flow. Like, I know I'll have the money, but there are bills and there, you know, it's a dance. And if you don't have outside investors, and if you don't have business loans, like, I'm running everything just debt free because I've grown it really, really slowly. And that's great. And it's solid, but it takes some real patience and faith because most people wouldn't have the luxury to, you know, grow something slow over 8 years, but because I'm a stay at home mom, it's also working. But, it's a lot of, prayer, you know, it's a lot of, hoping I make the right decisions because I don't have that in my history and like the business part of it. And it's good. It's good to focus on a local market where I've just decided, like, I'm going to focus on Denver. I'm not going to travel and like try to sell jackets at different locations yet because I'm not all in yet. I still have my youngest daughter. She's a preschool age. She's not in school yet. So, you know, I don't work on this full time, but I do. I do and I don't, you know, like I do right. at night.
Yes. That's the trick of small business, isn't it? Right.
Right. I mean,
there's no out, there's no clock in and clock out. Right. It's
And I love it. I mean, you'd have to love it. But yeah, just that dance of time management and cash flow with a small business and just being content to be very narrow with what I'm doing when I know I could do something else. I know I could go to Chicago and do the Chicago Marathon, you know, post-race party or expo and that, you know, and, you know, not to be arrogant, but I think I would do really well, you know, but to choose, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm going to focus on Denver. It's cheaper to just stay local while I'm growing things and it's easier on my family. So but of course, I mean, I'm online, but, that's a whole nother beast. Cause when you're doing original clothes online, it's not like someone could send something back and be like, oh, I need the next size up. It's like, well, that was an original. So
you're going to have a different look.
Yeah.
So, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So first I wanted to say Chicago is a huge running city and you would do very well here because it is so cold all winter, and people, I'm losing my mind, like, as yes. we speak, you know, like, it's been way too cold, way too long. But you had on something really interesting to me, and something I struggle with myself, mm-hmm. which is our culture with something like this, with any sort of enterprise, is so bent on immediate success, mm-hmm. right? Like, if that Instagram following isn't, like, growing, like, very quickly, and, you know, if people aren't, like, receiving you really quickly, you know, it's like, man, I've been doing this 6 months. How in the world am I not, like, super successful already? Right. Like, yeah. how do you, what is it that keeps pushing you forward with the lack of that sort of immediate, I guess, feedback?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. When I go really internal and I think, well, what would I do if I didn't do this anymore?
Yeah.
I think I would still just, like, make lots of jackets and, like, gift them to people. I mean, I think, yeah, if the ship goes down, what would I do?
Yeah.
There's, you know, the whole question of, like, well, where would I get a job? But then there's also the, well, what would I do for enjoyment question? And it's pretty much what I'm doing. And so
yeah.
it's kind of like, in my head, I can think, okay, Vander Jacket's over, I quit. And I go down and make some jackets. And then later that week, maybe someone sells online. Maybe I have a conversation with my husband or my mom and my dad. And I say, like, yeah, I don't know if it's really worth it. And usually they'll be like, well, why don't you just keep doing it? Like, it's, you know, think of where you've come from and think of how it's grown and what would you do anyway right now. So, like, just keep going. So sometimes it's just like realizing, yeah, this is deep in me and I love it. And maybe today I'm just doing it for myself because it's not feeling successful and I'm not feeling the feedback.
Yeah.
And then some other days it's my family telling me, like, no, this is really you and you're really doing something and I'm proud of you.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful. As an artist, it can be really great to not get the feedback and be kind of in a dry spell, because then you go, no one's listening anyway. What do I want to do? Because it's deep in me creatively. And then you make that jacket and it's always so much better. It's always so much better than responding to, oh, I like that red one you put. And, you know, 20 people, you know, speaking out and saying, like, that was awesome. Cause then I try to replicate that.
You try to replicate it. Right. Huh?
Yeah.
But that's a really good perspective. I right. like that. Huh?
So it's kind of like a, you know, the silence kind of forces you to get back to the love.
Yeah.
And, get back to the authenticity, and then you put that out and then people see that and people always respond to what's authentic. And I know for me, when I make a jacket that is, like, killer and I think I really want that one, like, I just yeah. want to keep it. I just want to go upstairs and put it in my closet and start running in it. Right. I know I nailed it.
Yeah.
And that people are going to love it because it really came from what I think is great. So.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I think you're really speaking to my soul with that. So, you know, even if no one else gets anything out of that, I got a lot out of that. Oh. I just feel like with Theology of Hustle, like, I've designed a lot of stuff, a lot of websites, a lot of other people's products, but
yeah.
Theology of Hustle is the first thing that's been just curry. Like, whatever I wanted to do gets thrown out there and it's on me to sort of, like, own it. You know what I'm saying? And so there's something very cathartic to that. Like, just letting it be you, right? And I guess there's some vulnerability to that too, you know, if people right. don't like it, especially as a three. But
right.
I really think that's a really great word for creativity. It's good.
Yeah.
Good job. Go ahead.
Oh, well, one thing that struck me this week, I went to an evening called Women Engage that they have at Denver Seminary. And it's like an evening for women and they have a speaker. And the latest speaker, her name was Angie. I think Angie, Hyde, but she quoted Frederick Buechner about what he said about calling. And he said that your calling is where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. And when I heard that, like, it was just so freeing, you know, because this does make me glad, you know? And so sometimes I think, you know, deep gladness, my deep gladness doesn't get a lot of feedback, but eventually like the deep hunger of the world is to see beautiful things that are well made and not beautiful things born on the backs of other people, but beautiful things made by people who have joy, you know, because there are a lot of things in the world that are beautiful, but they're not made in a way that is also beautiful. Because, you know, the fashion industry, there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of pollution. There's a lot of slavery, like human trafficking in the garment creation, you know, process. Like that's a reality and people are starting to learn that. So when they find somebody who made something that's beautiful, that speaks to their needs and is made well, like they get that, even if they can't afford it. You know, I think there's an interest there, and because there's a hunger that things could be beautiful through and through, you know, that the world wants to see beautiful things that are also quality, that are also the beautiful things that don't have a dark side underneath, you know?
Yeah. So well said. So well said. And I love what you're talking about there, because it speaks to this faith and work conversation that we're having. That they would take that quote though and make that all about, I don't know, social justice or like a very niche sort of thing. You know, this is where the world's hunger is, right?
Right.
But beauty is godly, I guess. You know, and there is that slavery piece to like sort of breaking down the systems that have like imposed slavery, like the, you know, consumerism and all of that stuff. But, but that beauty has value in this world, and like bringing beauty to this world is a valuable thing. Right.
Right. And then also on that, I love, this is not my own, but I loved hearing someone describe design as, like good design is compassionate. Because what you do, like, as a designer is think, how would this rub somebody wrong? Like, over the miles, this is going to rub their armpit wrong, you know? So if I design it this way, they won't have that. And that is a compassionate act to think about what are those annoyances that bring people down in life, you know? And how can I design something that just makes it better? You know, and people respond to that, even though they don't know what they're responding to when they put something on and it's right. Like it's just right, you know, because there are a lot of clothes in my closet, probably everyone's closet, where it's like, I like this element of this piece of clothing so much that I will wear this, but I hate how it, you know, at the end of the day, it really hurts right here, or these jeans really are too tight right here. But I'll wear these because, you know, 85% I love it. And then there's this one thing wrong. So for me, like to think about, I love this jacket, but if there were, you know, if there were one thing I could change, it would be this. And I love talking to the people who buy my jackets and you know, or just seeing people, all different shapes and sizes of people. Try on my jackets in my tent is like the biggest reward ever, you know, and to hear the first thing out of their mouth, be it, you know, positive or negative, because I do want to respond to that and react. And being small, I can literally, I could do a post-race expo, see a bunch of different people try on jackets and go home and like respond to the comments they made with the designs I make that week. And if you're bigger, you can't do that. And so that's, you know, one thing that is special about being small, a small business.
Yeah, you're on the ground and you see the people who are buying your stuff, right? You know them.
Yes. Yeah. So,
Yeah. Is there an analogy there to sort of how you know your jackets? You sort of know your customers and in different ways than like a bigger company would know their customers, right?
Right.
It's a one-on-one interaction.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. That's cool. I love that, that thinking about like faith and work is, which you've obviously done a lot of, yeah, just about how all that stuff like goes into sort of your design and what you do and all of that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so many different thoughts on that, you know, as they relate to like faith. I like to think of God as being the first fashion designer. because after the fall, like when Adam and Eve sinned, he made them clothes. You know?
Yeah.
And I thought a lot about that passage in Genesis and just thought, like, I bet he didn't make crappy clothes. I bet.
You know what? I never thought of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always been struck that he sacrificed animals to make the clothes to cover Adam and Eve's sin, and how there's so many layers there. There's the theological layer of like the sacrifice that had to be paid, you know, for sin.
Yeah.
But then also on a much shallower level, I think of like God took basically the best material in the world, like an animal skin. It's warm, it's flexible, it conforms to your body, it lasts forever. Like he went for the goods, like he went for the quality. Yeah, I always thought that was really interesting.
That is interesting. How have I guess I'm not a fashion designer, so I don't think through those things, but like that's really interesting because you know those clothes were like legit,
for
right?
Sure.
I mean, God made them himself.
For sure. Yeah.
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 I wonder if they like were buried in those clothes, you know?
Yeah. I mean, why would you need anything else?
Right.
You know?
They probably didn't last however old they were. Because they lived really long back then, but
they did live a long time. Yeah. But you know, quality's quality,
that's
right? You get what you pay
right.
for. You know,
yeah,
that's right. That's good. I love that. Well, I would be remiss if I did not at least sort of talk to you about your creative process. But also, you make all of your jackets from fabric that's like pre-existing, right? I mean, there's no like.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit just about like your process and your materials and
okay. I think a big part of my creative process is that I'm very limited. Like I think actually limitation really forces people to be more creative. So I don't have connections to, you know, fabric mills. I have connections at this point to like fabric wholesalers, but it, you know what? It's just easier to go out into Denver and find pieces of unused like fabric on the secondary market. I can feel it. I can visualize like, what am I going to make from this? What type of jacket? And the crazy thing about being in Colorado is that there really is a garment, like a gear garment history here. There's been a lot of athletic apparel made here and outdoor apparel. Yeah. And there's a history here of that. So there's actually a lot of excess fabric here that, you know, it didn't get used, or almost all of it got used except for a few yards. And I mean, it just comes up like on Craigslist or just like even ARC thrift stores or just like donations. There are different conduits, and I'm really scrappy and I'm kind of a maven. So I kind of enjoy the hunt and I know where to look at this point. Yeah. And
yeah,
I always thought, you know, starting the business this way, I always thought I'm going to run out of, you know, vintage poly, you know, because I work it in a lot of vintage polyester into my jackets with some more modern textiles. So they look unique and weird, or, you know, however you want to describe that. I thought that I would tap the flow and have to like go somewhere else and start looking for it, but I haven't. There's just so much excess out there. So that's the story on my fabric. It's all from the Denver area.
Well, so what is like a normal day of like fabric hunting look like for you? I mean, is this like on a day by day basis? Are you always sort of like in the hunt on Facebook Marketplace or whatever? Is it sort of a...
Well, you know, at this point, I just have such a huge supply. People who are into fabric and textiles, they have to struggle with the urge to hoard. So you don't want to hoard. Probably anybody who manufactures an actual like thing has the urge to hoard, you know, because that's part of the business. And I'm pretty good at letting stuff go. But at this point, I don't do the fabric hunting daily. I just kind of like keep an eye out. My mom is also kind of wired like me. And I set her loose every once in a while with my credit card, hunting around town. And she knows what to look for. So that's really fun. We have that in common. Yeah.
That's cool.
And then as far as my creative process goes, you know, I'm really a sculptor, I think, at heart. Like, I will just start cutting. Like, if I get a fabric that I like, or a few, and I like the way the colors are working, like, I'll just start cutting. And I have patterns that are set, but they're kind of like the base pattern. And then what I put on top is, cutting. And then where I get inspiration is movies, a lot of times. Movies and old European ski posters, the clothes people wear on those.
Yeah.
And old movies, like I said, I really like old things. Just looking at like vintage Nike ads, vintage, you know, Patagonia ads, and kind of like reading the history of some different like athletic gear makers and outdoors gear people. And then now the Outdoor Retailer Trade Show, which is this big trade show, is in Denver. And just going to that and just walking around and just looking at the colors and textures. Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of lucky where I am, because, you know, the big fashion hubs are obviously New York and Los Angeles. But with my history of, you know, my family and growing up in Oregon and around runners, being in Colorado and making outdoor gear is just a great fit. And I couldn't have planned that. So.
I mean, really, for your market, right? You're in as good a spot as you probably could be.
Yeah.
That's cool. I guess, so you mix sort of vintage, patterns or vintage fabric with sort of more modern textiles. Am I using all these words correctly? Okay. So, I guess in my mind, when I do design, like, color matching is like one of the hardest parts of getting a design to like look right. Right. Cause I mean, even like shades of different colors can throw something off significantly. Do you ever have issues with sort of these like vintage textiles and sort of the vintage, more vintage looking colors, and bringing in sort of a modern styling into those? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Okay. I think I live in a real, I think we live in a perfect age for fashion, because there's so much of everything out there. And I want to say, when you and I were younger, maybe our parents, I don't know if you had this, would tell you, oh, that doesn't match.
Yeah, right.
You know, or like, oh, that clashes.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I was always raised to think like pink and red, never, never, never.
Right.
Never wear pink and red. And like, we're really in a time in fashion where like there's just so much variation and there's no such thing as clashing.
Yeah.
And when you put the weird vintage fabric with, I don't know, blaze orange or something, people go, wow, that's cool. You know?
Yeah, totally.
And
totally.
It almost seems like when I downplay that, or when I resist the urge to kind of go crazy, that's where people aren't as excited, you know? And so I have a sister who just pretty much wears black and white. That's it. You know, she's not going to wear my jackets, ever.
Right.
And that's okay. Like, I get that, you know, everyone has their own style, and I'm not for everyone, but there's so much freedom right now with fashion. It's a good time to be doing weird stuff.
Yeah. Well, even with a lot of the 80s coming back, like, not only in graphic and web design, but also in like clothing, like, big time. Yeah. Like, I'm fluorescing right now, you know, with my clothing. So
totally.
I that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't quite considered that Because it really is a beautiful day to be alive with the fashion, right?
So. Oh yeah. And as a small business too, and as a podcaster. Yeah.
That is true. That is true. That is true. So how has your creativity changed, or your process of designing changed over the last 8 years? Is that like way too big of a question, or
no, that's not too big. Yeah, I think, okay. Well, when I started out, for example, I was afraid to put in zippers.
Right.
And so I did I was just making pullovers with a button.
Yeah.
And, you know, with time, a friend of mine was like, oh, you should really put in full zippers. And I was always thinking in my head when she would tell me that, no, I don't want to do that. So some of it was just insecurity. I was really insecure at first to put in zippers, and that I was getting sizing and shape right, you know? Because, you know, you start making jackets for yourself or you start making things that fit you so that fit myself. So I can try it on. I can go try it on and see if it works. And then, being in my tent and selling at race expos or flea markets and stuff, or just events, pop-ups, you know, people would say do you do my size? And that could be anyone from an extremely petite woman to a guy who likes to wear 2-3 XL, you know?
Right.
And, so over the years, I think the most I've changed is expanding to include more and more sizes. And even this last year, I started making extra, extra small. My jackets tend to run big. And I just wasn't hitting a group of people. And I'm the shortest in my family. My brother's 6'8", and I have really tall. My sister and my mom, they're taller than me. They're 5'11". And and so I naturally make things bigger and longer. And to interact with people and see them try on and see where it's tight on them. And immediately in the moment, wish that it wasn't, want to alleviate that. That has forced me to design for bigger sizes, smaller sizes. I had a woman in my booth over the holidays at a holiday sale. And she said, I hope you don't mind me telling this, but I had a double mastectomy and I'm having trouble fitting into these jackets. Can you suggest something for me? Cause people, when you're dealing with stuff that goes on the body, there's a lot of insecurity there. Yeah. And there's a lot of variation. And if you have a heart for people, you don't want them to feel uncomfortable. You want them to feel right. You know, you want them to put on your clothes and feel warm and, they have the functions they need, but also beautiful or handsome or whatever the case may be. So I think the most I've changed over the past 8 years is just to include more people, more sizes, to fit more bodies, to realize how I'm abnormal and how I need to change my designs to fit other people. And another thing is too, sometimes I've had people who, they're transgender. And they come in and I want to absolutely treat them with the most respect I can and help them find the color that speaks to them, find the pattern, find the fit that fits them, and to just treat them like I would want to be treated. So, over the years, there's been a lot of change with that. A change with size and people.
Yeah.
Just more experience, more people I've talked to. And yeah.
Yeah, that's a great word, I think, for all of us, not just in clothing design, but dignity and respect. But also it seems like some of your art teaching experience may come full circle there, and seeing almost seeing your jacket through other people's eyes, your design, or the way you build clothing, through other people's eyes to some extent.
Yeah. Maybe so. I hope so.
I think that's something we should all seek to do, right? See the world through others' eyes as much as we can, or at least with grace,
Right. I'm still learning that, but yeah.
It's a hard lesson. I think we learned that one over and over again,
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, cool. Let's jump into the final two questions. Okay. Yeah. Are you good with that?
Yeah. This has been so fun. I'm ready for those.
Perfect. Yeah. You've listened to a few of those.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Okay. I think the strangest job that I ever had was in college. I was a meter maid. You know, so like
really?
I walked around and you have to, you know, keep tabs on all the cars parked and write the tickets. And you're definitely very visible and very, very much the bad person who's writing the tickets. And I wanted that job because I thought, hey, I get to walk around and be outside all summer. This will be great.
Right.
But it was definitely a weird job. I was, again, like my motivation was to be outside and, you know, walk around and see people downtown and enjoy the day.
Yeah.
But it's funny because behind the scenes, like the people who run the tickets, like they will tell you, like, try to get a quota of tickets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it being a summer job for me, I was just kind of like, I'm not going to try and get a quota of tickets.
Right.
But, you know, I'll try. I'll try to, you know, do a good job, but I'm not going to try to like hit a number of tickets. But that was definitely a weird job.
Did you ever have interactions with people like really upset with you?
Occasionally. I almost feel like people were nicer because, I don't know, I want to say maybe because I was young and I was a girl.
Sure.
And so they didn't come down too hard on me because I would just smile and be like, yeah, I'm really sorry, but you could call this number on the ticket.
I don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious you're not in charge of these meters though, right?
Right. So, you're definitely the bad guy. So,
yeah. Right. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring the kingdom into their work?
There's a lot that could be said. I'm going to focus on the beauty part, though.
Okay.
I think when you're looking to bring the kingdom of God into your work, think about what is it about your work that is beautiful? It could be something extremely small. Like, it's beautiful how this other person knows how to buy a really nice kind of coffee for this office. Or it could be that you really like the color of the back fire escape where you go take a break or whatever. Focus on what's beautiful and kind of bring that back in, you know, let that, you know, think about it and let it rejuvenate you through your day. Think about it a little bit more and then try to push that back to other people. Cause people do respond to beauty and it's easy to go through the day and not think about the beautiful things and the things that kind of just give you a little bit of joy.
Yeah.
But it's easy to call those things beautiful and think about it a little bit more than you would. Thank God for it and bring it back to your work.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a good word. I love that. I love seeking beauty in all things. I think that's great. Well, Sarah, it was such a pleasure to meet you and get to chat and talk about some jackets and, you know, some work and stuff. So,
it was so great, Curry. I really appreciate it. Yeah. And
I love,
keep it up with the podcast. I love the variety of occupations you've brought in. And I can't recommend enough the interview with Helen. It was my favorite. So I want to say that.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the feedback though is greatly appreciated. So thank you. It really does mean a lot. And
good.
It's been great interacting with you. I'm sure we'll see each other on Instagram or, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely.
One of those things, so.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yep.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Sarah. I think even going back and listening to it as I was editing the episode, I'm just so captivated by this idea that she brought out of just being gracious to people, of treating other people like you want to be treated. I know that is something we all know already. There's no novel concept there, but it's something I need to be reminded of over and over again. And so I just got that little insight out of this again, just to like ask God to come into those places where I don't have grace, where I, you know, judge people, or where just, you know, he needs to take away some of that sin in my my life. So that was my nugget. If you have a little something that you got out of the episode, I'd love to hear about it. Love to talk about this episode. Make sure that you use that offer code. All that info should be in the show notes for you to find it. If you can't find it, something goes wrong, please let me know. We'll get you taken care of. Yeah, make sure you're following Vanderjacket on Instagram. So until next time, get out there and hustle.